Frescoes, films and a famous city, San Francisco, commemorate the church's most popular saint, the humble brother, St. Francis. Hello, I'm Rachel Kahn, and on today's Spirit of Things on Radio National abc.net.au/rn, the saint who brings together Protestants and Catholics and whose love of nature has made him an environmental icon.
Brother Sun and Sister Moon, I seldom see you, seldom hear your tune.
Of course, San Francisco is not the place with which St. Francis is historically associated. That honor goes to Assisi, the town in central Italy, where in 1230 his body was laid in the Basilica of San Francesco, 4 years after his death. Now, 800 years after the founding of his order of brothers in 1209, St. Francis remains a popular figure. But an order that's lasted so long is bound to undergo all sorts of variations. And today I speak to Brother Wayne of New South Wales, a Franciscan brother who is a hermit. It's a fascinating choice of life, and we'll hear about it later in the program. Almost at the other end of the spectrum is Ilia Delio, a Franciscan sister based in Washington, D.C. She holds 2 doctorates in pharmacology and historical theology. She's the director of the Franciscan Center at Washington Theological Union and has an abiding interest in Franciscan spirituality and the nexus between science and religion. I was keen to meet her. Sister Ilia Delio, welcome to the Spirit of Things.
Thank you.
Well, is it a fair guess to say that St. Francis is the most popular saint?
Yes, I think that's a very good guess, that St. Francis is the saint for all ages. It seems every age comes to know Francis and love him. Even in our own age of rapid globalization and pluralization, I find people of many cultures and many religions look to Francis as a great and holy person.
I guess that would be because he appeals to our almost childlike or innocent qualities, a love of nature, a love of animals.
Yes, I do think that certainly is part of it, his great love of creation. I think, too, his sense of goodness of the human person, his sense of community, his care for the poor, all speak to people of a great humanity, a great human being.
Now, the real Francesco, and I gather that wasn't his original name, but one given to him by his father, he had a pretty colorful life before he heard the call from
yes.
God. Can you fill that out a bit for us?
Yes, I can tell you a little bit, at least from what we know from his biographer, Thomas of Celano. Francis was baptized as Giovanni. However, his father was a cloth merchant and traveled often to France. And upon his return, the name was changed to Francis. Francis himself loved to sing in French, although he knew French very little. He grew up in what we would call today a middle-class family. He helped in his father's store, selling cloth. He was, as Thomas tells us, a rather vain, flamboyant young man. He loved nice things, good parties, lots of friends, and to be the center of attention. Everyone loved Francis, and he loved to be loved by everyone. One of Francis's aspirations was to be a famous knight. It was the age of chivalry. And his dream was to be someone famous, someone who won the battle. But he lost the battle, actually. His army was captured, and he was wounded. And he was recovering in what we could call a soldier's hospital. And while he was recovering, he began to rethink his life. He had several dreams, actually, according to the biographies. And in one of the dreams, he saw a room of instruments. The instruments were swords and shields, all from battle, and they were emblazoned with the sign of the cross. And he heard the voice of the Lord say to him, "Francis, is it better to serve the master of the army or the true master?" And Francis said, "Well, of course I want to serve the true master." he awoke realizing his life was moving in the wrong direction. After that, he began to move away from the center of popularity and parties and material things, and he began to pray. He went often to lonely, abandoned churches and just stayed there for long periods of time in prayer. One of the major episodes in the life of Francis is the kiss of the leper. Up to his early conversion, Francis had a great disdain of lepers. He just was completely repulsed by them. And after he began to pray, he met a leper one day, and instead of holding his nose and galloping away, which was his normal response, he got down from his horse and he kissed the leper's hand, and he gave the leper alms. And he got back on his horse to go away, and he turned around to see the leper once again, and there was no leper in sight. And some scholars say that the story, while real, is also symbolic of Francis's life, that he had to come to terms with his own inner leper, so to speak, what repulsed him, maybe even within his own self.
I want to ask you about that, because I would imagine that in trying to find out about St. Francis's life, it would be difficult to separate the truth from the legend.
Yes. And to answer your question a little bit more directly, we don't know. In other words, Francis himself left us no details of his own life. The only life we have of Francis is the life constructed by other Franciscans, namely Thomas of Celano and Bonaventure, are the two main biographers. Now, Francis himself, however, did leave about 10 letters in his own writing, his own handwriting, as well as several prayers and true rules of the way of life. He has about 38 writings in total. And that's where we begin to see the difference between Francis, the man on his way to God, and Francis, the saint, constructed by the biographers. And there's really a profound difference between the two.
Well, one of the most cherished stories, I think, of St. Francis is his friendship with a certain wolf or wild dog that was threatening a village.
Yes. The story of the wolf of Gubbio. Again, that's told in the legenda, one of the stories passed around about Francis. And it's interesting, that story seems to occur later on in his life. You know, he had achieved a level of sanctity, so to speak, or a level of deep union with God. And he came to the village of Greccio, where the people were afraid to come out of their houses because a ravenous wolf was in the midst. And Francis, instead of going into the city with fear, like the other people, he asked to see the wolf. He was going to have a word with him. Francis approached the wolf as a man of peace. And he spoke to the wolf. First, he admonished the wolf by saying, you know, that's terrible that you're terrorizing the city and you are eating the people's food and attacking the people. He said, I want you to stop. The wolf, in a sense, said to Francis, the reason I'm doing this is that I'm hungry. What Francis, you know, like many of the saints, because they attained a level of inner sanctity, they were at peace with all of creation. So Francis could listen to the wolf and the needs of the wolf. And he said, look, I will make sure that you have enough food to eat as long as you promise not to keep terrorizing the people of this city. And so Francis made peace with the wolf by attending to his needs. And the story ends by saying that the wolf became a beloved creature of the town of Greccio, or Gubbio, I should say.
And I think he was baptized
by Saint Francis.
Well, at present, Saint Francis is being promoted as an early proponent of dialogue with the Muslim world. Now, it sounds a bit far-fetched to me, but what's the story behind that?
Yes. Francis had a desire to preach the gospel and to preach the gospel in such a way that he would be able to offer his life in imitation of Christ for the sake of the gospel. He had a great desire for martyrdom, and he had tried to embark on one of the crusades in his career and several times failed. However, around 1219, he was able to join a crusade on the way to the Holy Land, and he made his way to Egypt. It was not an easy time for him. He was actually captured with one of the other brothers, and there might have been some physical harm to him at that point. But he persevered, and he made his way to the Sultan, Malik el-Kamil. He wasn't there for dialogue. He was there really to preach the gospel. So one of the things we don't want to do is collapse the event of Francis's life with our pursuit of interreligious dialogue. And for him, he was ready to be martyred, you know, in order to preach the gospel. And what he said to the Sultan is, in a sense, we have the true gospel. And I'll tell you it's true. Set a fire, and I'd be willing to walk through the fire because I so believe in this gospel of Jesus Christ, and I want you to know it's the truth. Well, the Sultan was baffled, if not, you know, scared by Francis. They didn't set up the fire for him to walk through, but they did enter into a dialogue or a conversation. And I think, at least from what we know from the accounts, what they met was more of a common ground of mutuality. He was open, at least, to hearing what the Muslim religion was about and was actually impressed by, first of all, the peaceful attitude of the Sultan. He saw him as a man, a holy man of deep prayer. Francis was impressed by the names of Allah and actually seems to have brought those names or incorporated them in some of his own prayers, for example, the praises of God. He was impressed by the Muslims' call to prayer and also borrowed that from them. So what began as, you might say, a crusade ended as a dialogue of mutual respect.
And I suppose that story underlines the sense of openness in the Franciscan spiritual tradition?
Yes, I think it's openness on Francis himself in particular. Francis's life is really governed by a God of humble, compassionate love. It's the God he meets in the crucified Christ. And in meeting that God, it opened him up to meeting God's overflowing goodness in all peoples, in all aspects of creation. And I think his going into dialogue or meeting with the Sultan is because he believed in the goodness of God and he saw that goodness in the Sultan.
Well, in 1209, St. Francis established an order, a brotherhood, but he would also support Sister Claire in establishing an order for women. Is that where the Franciscan sisters come in?
Yes, in a root sense. In Francis's time, there is a great evangelical awakening that involves both laymen and women. Now, Francis and Claire knew each other before they began on this spiritual way of evangelical life. She actually was known as the Holy One. She grew up in a household of holy women, and Francis was the troubadour, you know, who would hang out in the local piazza below her window. And they seem to have been friends. She was 12 years younger than Francis. Scholars claim that Claire may have been more influential on Francis than Francis on Claire. So when Francis began to live the gospel life as a layman, and Claire desired to join him in that way of life, so when she left her household, her intention was to join Francis and the brothers at the Portiuncula to be part of their way of life, to live this new gospel or evangelical way of life. Is that the beginning of the sisters? Yes, in the sense that the Franciscan movement began as a movement of men and women, not just men alone.
People say you're mad. Do you know that? When you went off to war, they said you were fine and intelligent. But now you're mad. Because you sing like the birds, and you chase after butterflies, and you look at flowers. I think you were mad before. Not now.
Sister Claire from the Franco Zeffirelli 1972 film Brother Sun, Sister Moon, about the life of St. Francis. My guest today is Franciscan Sister Ilia Dilio, who holds the chair of spirituality studies at Washington Theological Union. Later, we'll hear from a Franciscan hermit in northern New South Wales. You're with the Spirit of Things on ABC Radio National and online at abc.net.au/rn/spiritofthings. What would you say is the feminine expression of the Franciscans compared to the male order of the Franciscans?
Well, that's an interesting question insofar as one can identify, and I think I myself have written about this, the feminization of Franciscan spirituality, because we can find the feminine in Francis's own spirituality. Francis spoke often about himself as a mother. For example, in his letter to Brother Leo, he says, "I am addressing you as a mother, you know, who loves her son." So this idea of the feminization of spirituality for Francis was really the emphasis on God's compassionate love, the emphasis on God's descent into our humanity in Christ. The women in the Middle Ages had a very limited status. Women were dependent on men. And Francis's entering into poverty and humility, Francis's way of life is in a sense a feminization, because he becomes like women, dependent on God and on others. Now, that changes as theologians enter the order, and especially theologians trained in scholastic theology. While there are elements of Francis's way of life or his thought that are maintained among the male theologians, it does become more intellectual. Claire, for example, I think she really captured the essence of Francis's spirituality, and I think it's Claire who preserves the heart of Francis's spirituality in her own writings. And I could see that same preservation in other women mystics, for example, Angela of Foligno or Veronica Giuliani several centuries later on. So I would say the best of Francis's way of life, insofar as it's a spiritual way of life, is maintained and nurtured by the women.
Sister Ilia, did the Franciscan interest in creation, in nature, generate a particularly scientific form of scholasticism?
Yes and no. And I would say no first in this way. The interest in creation finds its root in the incarnation. When we lose sight of Jesus Christ as the center of creation here, we can easily overlook the fact that Francis's movement into creation is because Francis moved into the mystery of Christ. Now, what Francis and Franciscans emphasized is that this created world is good, it's holy because God has entered into it. And therefore, it's worthy of our observation, our attention, and our introspection. And it's that emphasis on creation that does give rise to science. And the Franciscans, beginning in the 13th century, particularly with the school at Oxford, are promoters of Western science. For example, Robert Gross Attest, who was not a Franciscan himself, but a great teacher of the Franciscans, had a whole theory on light, a whole metaphysics of light, and himself gave rise to insights that helped formulate optics. His successor, Roger Bacon, was one of the great early scientists of the late Middle Ages into the Renaissance. So yes, the emphasis, but it's incarnation that makes creation worthy of our attention and our connectivity, and it's that that makes knowledge of creation through science an endeavor for the Franciscans.
Well, you would be right in there, being a biomedical scientist yourself.
Yes, right. I did it backwards, actually. I started as a scientist, and through science, I was a neuroscientist, actually, in brain and spinal cord research. And I was so awed by the intricate complexity of the nervous system. I thought, there is simply no way that we could have created this ourselves. And I was, in a sense, led back to God by the beauty of the human physiology of who we are.
So is that why you became a Franciscan sister?
Well, to answer that honestly, no. I kind of slipped into the Franciscans through the back door. I began as a Carmelite, a Discalced Carmelite, a cloistered nun. So I began with a life of prayer and contemplation. I was very inspired by Thomas Merton and his book, The Seven Story Mountain. And my initial intention was to go to the desert and to live entirely for Christ. So I abandoned a career in science. I abandoned a postdoc at Johns Hopkins University. I went to the monastery to live for Christ, but then I realized it's not as easy as it sounds. What I missed perhaps in the monastery, and for me, was interaction with the world. And I was sent to the Franciscans because I went back to scientific research, and there was a group of Franciscans who lived nearby the university. And so I just went to live with them and realized they had a compatible spirit to my own. I loved the joy of Franciscan community, the simplicity of the Franciscan life that still has prayer at the center of the life. And I guess what I love about the Franciscan tradition is precisely the fact that it takes this created world seriously as the place where God dwells.
Well, I know that your area of specialty is integrating Franciscan spirituality and contemporary questions that we're faced with today. So what are the kinds of issues that you think the Franciscan perspective can help to address in a profound and meaningful way?
I think if I were to answer your question briefly, I would say three points. One is, we know today from science this is an evolutionary universe. Franciscan theology, although it grew up in the Middle Ages, the theology is such that it can provide insights that can help deepen our understanding of God at work in an evolutionary universe. One would be the primacy of Christ tradition, which we hold as Franciscans, that Christ did not come because of sin. Christ is first in God's intention to love and to create. So the whole creation is made for Christ, which puts a whole new emphasis on being Christian in this world. Second is the inherent goodness of creation, that creation flows out of a God of love. And it's because it flows out of a God of love, it is by its very nature, it is love. It is ultimately good. And that ultimate goodness, you might say, is what it's love that moves this creation onwards. So whereas science says, you know, things evolve because, atoms form molecules and molecules form cells, from a theological perspective, we say that happens because God's goodness is at the heart of this whole evolutionary process. So evolution and God's action in this world is one area. The second area is ecology. When we talk about ecology or the household of creation, I think Franciscan spirituality has a tremendous wealth of insight to offer here. We spoke before about creation and Francis, and certainly that is part of it. But what we believe is that this creation is endowed with an inherent goodness, and therefore there's an inherent relationality to creation. We have a responsibility to creation. It's not an option to care for the earth. It's a mandate as being human beings. We are part of the web of life. And so Franciscan spirituality can help deepen our understanding of what it means to be part of this web of life in an ongoing creative process. The third is that Franciscan theology, in a sense, it gives us direction towards what an evolutionary or an emergent evolutionary universe is going. And for us as Franciscans, it's the fullness of Christ. We maintain this evolutionary universe has meaning and purpose. And that gives purpose to our lives. We're not here just, you know, bumping along and dragging ourselves through each day. It's awakening to our consciousness that as Christians, we have to participate in the unfolding in this universe if it is to attain its fullness in Christ. So in that way, we live with a hope and a promise.
Well, some of what you said sounds a bit like creation spirituality almost. That is, when you hold the view that nature is inherently good, it seems to bump up against a kind of tradition of Catholic orders which condemned nature, particularly sexuality comes to mind. How do contemporary Franciscans then view sexual issues today, whether it's contraception or homosexuality or those sorts of things which the church is still struggling with?
Yes. To take your question in its first part, you know, where did that anti-creation mentality come in? You know, I think we need to keep in mind that as long as, from the Christian perspective, we speak as God as creator, we must hold that creation is good. Now, where the, you might say, mentality of transcending creation or even seeing creation as an evil may have come in is the strong influence of Greek metaphysics. The thought of Plato, for example, overshadowed a lot of Christian spirituality. And basically, Platonic metaphysics held that there is no true reality on this earth. In fact, this is a changing, mutable world. It suffers, it decays, it's violent. So God cannot be involved in a messy world. You know, I always say to my students, the question is, what is a nice God like you doing in a world like this? So the Neoplatonic idea was you have to get away from the world. And Neoplatonism would put the emphasis on spiritual reality. And therefore, to go to that spiritual reality, we must move away from material reality. So traditional religious life, where the three obstacles are the world, the flesh, and the devil. You know, so when you went to traditional religious life, you were to avoid any talk of sexuality, anything that would deal with bodily or material reality. And then you would focus your sights on the God above.
And it goes so much against the notion of an incarnate God.
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, this has been the problem, you know, which I think we are coming into a clearer focus in identifying at this point. We have maintained a Christian claim, but we have been acting as anti-incarnational people. So where are we today with regard to sexuality and regard to some of these more complex issues that technology has, in a sense, brought about with stem cell research, you know, etc., homosexuality? You know, I would say, as a Franciscan theologian who has, you know, studied Bonaventure for a long time, if we hold that God is good and God is the source of all that is, then we cannot hold at the same time to an intrinsic evil. That is, it is simply not possible. In my view, Francis would love people as they are. And he accepted persons in their own personhood, not to judge them, not to condemn them, because the judgment and condemnation overrides the goodness that's there, and we fail to see the good there. So the Franciscan tradition tends on the side of inclusivity because it focuses on the goodness of that which is. If stem cell research can ultimately promote life, if it can promote the goodness of life in this earth, is that bad? I think in the end, we'd have to say no. What we never want to do is misuse the gifts that God has given us. And we don't want the ends of our products to be only for us. Anything we do must ultimately be returned to God.
Well, it sounds like the medieval saint from Italy is a modern saint for today. Sister Ilia, thank you so much for being on The Spirit of Things.
Thank you, Rachel.
Sister Ilia Delio has written many books, including Franciscan Prayer and The Humility of God, A Franciscan Perspective. She's the director of the Franciscan Center at Washington Theological Union in Washington, D.C. You're with The Spirit of Things on Radio National, abc.net.au/rn. And this is St. Francis.
I want to be happy. I want to live like the birds in the sky. I want to experience the freedom and the purity that they experience. There must be something better. There has to be. Man is a spirit. He has a soul. And that is what I want to recapture. My soul.
from Franco Zeffirelli's 1972 film Brother Sun, Sister Moon, which presented St. Francis as the original hippie, rejecting war and materialism. But it's not far off the mark. For Brother Wayne, the Franciscan life has led him, after some years, to the life of a hermit in northern New South Wales. Brother Wayne, welcome to the Spirit of Things.
Thank you, Rachel.
Now, you just told me that this was your third trip down to Sydney in 21 years?
That's right.
I guess being a hermit, you don't travel much.
We usually go out and do two or three things for the church outside, usually on meditation and prayer, mainly because it would be very easy to be out all the time talking about meditation and prayer instead of actually practicing it. And we get quite a lot of invitations, so we thought we would only go out two or three times a year. And I've managed to come to Sydney three times in 21 years.
Well, it must be pretty nice then in Tabulum, where your hermitage is.
Yes, well, I love it, yes.
What's it like? Where is it exactly?
If you're going up the New England Highway, the last town in New South Wales is Tenterfield. If you turn towards the coast then and went down the bottom of the mountain range in the foothills there.
How long has the hermitage been established there?
We've been there 21 years, yes.
Gosh, and how long have you been a brother, a Franciscan brother?
I've been a brother for 42 years.
What was your life like before as a Franciscan brother that made you want to go into the hermetic life?
I think I've probably always wanted to do it. But when I joined the Franciscans, there really wasn't the possibility because we were involved in active ministry as a whole. But I think deep down that's what I always wanted to do. And so I did quite a lot of different things as a Franciscan brother. And then there came a possibility. We had a time of dreaming about what we wanted to do and realised that we couldn't do it within the group we were in, so we launched out and did it. There was three of us who were dreaming the same sort of dream, and our paths had come together.
And as a Franciscan brother, initially you were within the Anglican Church.
That's right, yes.
And that's the interesting thing about the Franciscans. They're across the Anglican Church and the Catholic Church.
And I think there's Franciscans in the Lutheran Church too.
Is that right? So yeah. What is it that all binds you? Do you have a common rule?
No. Within the Roman Catholic Church, there is what's called the rule of St. Francis, but there's, again, interpretations of it. I really think the real inspiration is Francis himself. And I think I'd make a distinction between following Francis and being inspired by Francis, because I think different groups are inspired by different dimensions of his life.
What would you say your group is inspired by? Is there a particular dimension in Francis's life?
Yes, I think it's the forgotten dimension, and that is that he really was a man who sought solitude, had a deep, passionate love for Christ, and really was a mystic. And it was really out of that time in prayer and solitude that he did the other things. But then he was also a great preacher, and so wherever he went, crowds would gather. But one of the stories I like about him is that he said to one of the brothers, they're going to such and such a town to preach. So they set off, got to the town, and he began to wander through the town, and he talked to different people, and they got to the market square, and the brother obviously thought, well, this is the place you got to stop and preach, and the crowds will come in. He didn't. And then he got to the church, and he didn't go into the church except to pray briefly, and he then continued, and he hadn't preached, and they got out the other side, and of course the brother was a little confused by this, and he said to Francis, I thought we'd come here to preach. And Francis says, well, we have. What do you mean? And he said, well, we are the sermon. So I think that whole thing of who we are and the more that we become Christ-like, it's the real important part of the journey of the hermitage in particular, because it's not about high visibility. The more my personal conversion goes on, and particularly with the brothers I live, that affects everything I do, the people I meet outside.
How many people would you meet, say, in a month?
Not a lot. We go down to the local town once a week. We would go into Casino, which is the biggest town nearby, probably once a fortnight. And then we occasionally have someone stay with us. We've got a guest cottage for one person. But like Brother Jeffrey, one of our brothers at the moment, is going to enter into 4 months of just living alone, and we will only see him every 2 weeks.
How does that affect the other two, you and the other monk? I mean, is that difficult to live with?
It's funny. I feel closer sometimes to Brother Geoffrey when he's in solitude than when we're together in the place doing things. I can't really explain it, but I have a real sense of connectedness that's not related to physically seeing him and just knowing that the intention of how he's living that period of time is strengthening us all. And it's an intangible sort of thing.
Do you each have a certain gift? I mean, is he the grand contemplative as opposed to the other two of you? Or do you each have a different kind of personality, different religious personality, if I can put it that way?
I think spiritually we're quite different. That also reflects our personality. I would think we have 80% in common. Otherwise it wouldn't work. We're a very small group. We're completely dependent on each other. But we're very, very different people, and we have a very different way of developing that personal relationship. I mean, we have things in common, like a routine of prayer together, meditation, but the way we approach it is quite different.
Tell me what a typical day would be like in the hermitage, or perhaps a week.
Day might be easier, because you've got to allow for fences coming down and floods and all sorts of unexpected things. Between about 2 and 4... we would get up and we would have a night office, which is a construction of scriptural readings and psalms and things. And then we would have spiritual reading. Now, we do that alone in our hermitage. Then we come down to the common prayer room at 6 o'clock for an hour of silent prayer together. And then we have another office, which is about half an hour. So that would bring us up to about 7:30. Then from 7:30 to 8, we do morning chores and get our own breakfast, and we're still in silence. And then about 8:30, we would have morning conference and we would discuss what we need to do together. And then we would finish that with another office, and then we would work together in the morning. So we might have to go and cut firewood for the wood stove, or we might have to go and do something in the garden or whatever. Then at midday, we have our midday prayers, and then we get our own lunch, and then in the afternoon, we work alone. Then at 6 o'clock, we have Vespers, which is another office, and then a time of silence after that, and a meal at 7, which one of us will cook. And then after that, we have night prayers or compline.
And when do you go to sleep?
Well, that would finish about 8, and personally, it varies, so some person may be very tired that night and may go to sleep fairly promptly. I usually read for a couple of hours, probably. I'm a great reader.
Do you have a decent library there?
We've got a sufficient library for 3 people, yes. And we also use the public library for other things too.
Well, I know that you've got sheep and goats and you also make things like the beautiful cross you've got around your neck. Are they the things that keep the 3 of you occupied?
Yes, and we've got bees and a big, very large vegetable garden, and particularly Brother Howard, he makes jams and marmalades, which we sell, parishes sell on our behalf. And occasionally when we go out to a parish, we'll take a ute load of things after church, pull the back down and flog it off the back.
So you have to support yourself,
yes,
obviously.
Yeah.
Is it enough to support you, to keep you going?
No. It's nearly enough, but there's other things that happen. Sometimes unexpected gifts from people, or someone will do something. Well, to give you an example, we've been wanting a crucifix for our chapel. We looked at catalogues and stuff. We didn't like any of them and we couldn't afford them. Anyhow, there was a parish in Queensland that had ordered a statue of Mary and a crucifix from Bali. They liked the statue of Mary, but they didn't like the crucifix, and the priest happened to know through another priest that we were interested in getting a crucifix, and it was just perfect for us because it was carved into a piece of timber. So the body of Christ, if you looked at the back of it, it just looks like a tree, and if you look at the front, you've got the corpus carved into it. It just blends in with all our bush furniture in the prayer room. Now, we could neither have imagined it nor paid for it, and that just came left field.
I guess a lot of people would say it must be a great life, but how does the rest of society benefit from it?
I'm not sure society benefits from it. What I would say the monastic contemplative life has got to offer is that it says that the most important thing is our relationship with God. And if you're going to have a relationship with someone, you've got to spend time. It doesn't happen in a vacuum. And we're just one part of the church. I mean, the church is involved in caring for the poor and preaching and a whole variety of things. But it needs a little group to say that's legitimate and part of the whole Christian vocation. But we've got to remember the first commandment is to love God. And if you're going to love someone, you've got to get to know them better. And that's done through prayer and meditation and silence and listening.
Has your relationship to God changed over those 42 years?
A lot. I think partly it's to do with the experience of life, because our perception of God when you're 5 or 15 or 25 or 35 or 55 or 65, unless it changes with your own experience of life, then you're stuck with an idol of whatever age you've stopped working on it. So, you know, some people really have a Sunday school understanding of God because that's where they've left off, working at that relationship and allowing God to interact with them. I think when I'm talking about us, one of the things I love is there's a little saying that says, if you're seeking God, much more is the beloved seeking you. So we're being sought.
Mm.
And yes, that's been my experience.
Lord, make me an instrument of your peace. Where there is hatred, let me sow love. Where there is injury, let me sow pardon. Where there is doubt, let me sow faith.
Has it been an easy life, or have you had times where you just wanted to pack up and leave?
It can be very bumpy. I think like all life, you don't make a once-for-all decision. I mean, I'm not married, but I know from married people I've in contact with this, where you start at the beginning of the marriage and you make your marriage vows, I mean, that's not it. You've really then got to work through what that means. So I think with religious vows as a brother, it's the same thing. You come with an idea, and if it's real vocation, you've got to keep working at it.
How about people coming into the Hermitage? I mean, I would imagine that a lot of people have romantic visions of it, romantic ideas of it, and want to join life with you. Does that happen?
It does, and, well, they don't last. There's nothing wrong if it's romantic, but it's got to then be grounded in reality. I mean, you can have a calling, understanding that it's about deepening your relationship with God, it's about living in a loving community, and it's about prayer. Well, that's true, but those things are all hard yakka in the end. Living in community can be quite difficult. Prayer can be quite difficult if you're sick or you're tired or you've got a time when you have a real sense of God's absence and you've still got to keep praying. That's the bit that makes you really grow.
Does the figure of St. Francis help you in that respect? I mean, he was a colourful personality and certainly not an easy one.
Well, I'd agree with all that. I think that's why I say I'm inspired by Francis and I don't follow. Where I would draw guidance would be from our Lord and from his teaching. And then I would draw quite heavily on the Desert Fathers because I see them as practitioners. I often find particularly in the Desert Fathers, the practical advice I'm looking for. As in Francis, I see much more the inspirational things, like I mentioned with the preaching or the way he went out and cared for the lepers who were living on the margins of society, or how he lived in the church, which was in badly need of reform. And he didn't really criticise it. He just lived the gospel life, which was a way of really critiquing the church without leaving it. So I find all those things inspirational rather than the details. I would find the more helpful things in the gospel than our Lord's teaching and the Desert Fathers.
What's your relationship with the rest of the Anglican Church?
Good, I hope. But we live on the margins, yes.
And do they have a good idea of what you're about and the value of your life?
No. I mean, it's a common problem with society as a whole. We value people in terms of usefulness, production and busyness. And we don't really understand or have much understanding as a society, I mean, and probably as a church, because church is very influenced by society. It was made up of people from society. So we often get, you know, what do you do? What is your ministry? So I think that whole idea of wasting time in God's presence is a concept fairly foreign to a society that's focused on production and busyness, and a church that gets seduced by that too, I think.
Is that why you removed yourself from the Society of St. Francis in the Anglican Church?
No, I think the society would have been very sympathetic to it. I think that the charism of that particular community is really about ministry to a large extent. It's prayer and ministry, but it's really the rule, or the vision that Francis had for hermitages doesn't quite fit in to the charism of that particular community. And that it's like in the Catholic Church, different communities express different dimensions of Francis. And that's often why there's either new communities or reform communities or different communities that pick up a little part of the inspiration of Francis. And I think at the moment you see in the Anglican Church, basically we've only got one community, which has been an amalgamation of a number of communities. And we really want to do something that's really quite different, which is in the hermitage tradition.
And yet you're still recognised within the Anglican Church. You're still under some authority.
We are, yes, and we are recognised.
Are you under the bishops?
Well, there's what's called the Advisory Council, which is appointed by the House of Bishops, and there's two bishops on that, one of which is the chairman, and then there's two other appointed people, and then there's one representative from all the recognised communities. And it's their job for any community that wants to be recognised to approach that group, and then they will do a number of things. You need to have a constitution, they'll visit you and talk to you, and there's a procedure of acceptance within that group, which we've gone through and been recognised within our own right. But, I mean, we were in pretty good standing anyhow when we left, because, I mean, I've been a brother for 20 years, so we weren't just sort of, you know, inexperienced people saying, you know, we're this or that, yeah.
So you're still a canonical order?
We are, yes.
Have you ever been to Assisi in Italy?
I have. About the fourth year that we were at Tabulum, we decided we hadn't got any animals at that stage, and we decided that once we got any animals, the three of us couldn't go away, and we thought if we went to Assisi, it was really important the three of us experienced it together, and we really focused on going to the hermitages associated with Francis. And it was very powerful experience for us, because we would read about the hermitages, what had happened, and then we would go and visit them and spend time in the places.
So it was a pretty positive experience for all of you?
Wonderful. Mm.
And does that continue to inform your vision back home?
Yes, it does. What was really interesting for us is that quite often we've done things and then found it within the tradition, rather than we've tried to reproduce something that's there. And just the most simplest things, like when we eventually constructed our chapel, prayer room, whatever, or the place where we prayed in common, we thought, well, what are we going to call it? So we talked about chapel and oratory and all this stuff, and we said, no, it's really a room for prayer. It's a prayer room. And, of course, most people come and say, they'd say, well, where's the chapel? And this mob is calling it a prayer room. Anyhow, when we began to read some of the early documents about the Franciscan hermitages, the chapel was actually called a prayer room, and it only became an oratory when they got altars and they got clergy. So often we've done things and then discovered them later within that sort of tradition.
I guess choosing to become a hermit is a really big step. What was it in your life that made you want to first pursue the monastic life and then the hermetic life?
I grew up in an unchurched family. And then when I was 15, I met the most remarkable Roman Catholic nun. She was quite elderly. I think she was in her 70s when I met her. And I got introduced to the life of the sisters. And that was just such a cultural shock, because it was just so different. Like, it was like a parallel universe to anything I'd experienced. And I saw their dedication. I saw their commitment as sisters, their prayer life. And I developed a wonderful relationship with Sister Mercedes at 15. But I also met a priest, an Anglican priest, who spoke about Jesus not as an historical person, but someone he was in relationship with. And I found that really challenging. And so those two people altered the whole direction of my life. And, of course, that was confusing at that stage, being unchurched and not realising that at that stage there wasn't terribly good relationships between the two churches.
When you say you were unchurched, does that mean your parents didn't raise you in any particular tradition?
That's right, yes. I think my father had a lot of problems with the church, and Mum less so, but we never went to church.
Well, gosh, it must have been quite radical for them.
It was.
They probably thought they were saving you from the church, and then you went, you know, you took a headlong dive right deep into the deep end.
Did indeed. I remember my father saying, in one moment exasperation, why don't you at least, I mean, if you're going to go into the church, why don't you become a priest? At least you can get married and you'll have a salary. But being a monk, you've got neither.
So how did you convince them?
I didn't. I think now my father has, over all the years, seen that I'm happy, and that's content. And my mother's died a number of years ago, and I think she came to the same conclusion. If I wasn't going to be happy, I would have left a long time ago. But, you know, I am happy.
Can I ask you finally, you know, St. Francis has been a popular icon in so many ways. He's now practically the environmentalist saint. But back in the 70s, he was a hippie icon. Franco Zeffirelli made the film Brother Sun, Sister Moon, and there were other films as well. Did they have any influence on you at all?
None. But I don't, in fact, I think it's okay. One of the things about Francis is he's really like, well, he's like a diamond or a multifaceted gem. Some people will just get one part of the inspiration. And I think that's fine. I mean, it would be wonderful if they really went further and really realised what a very Christ-centred and Christ-loving person he was. But if they just pick up the fact that his great love for creation, because it was God's creation, well, maybe that's enough for them and not to worry too much about it, or that he was a peacemaker or whatever, you know, all the dimensions of his life.
Well, it's 800 years since the Order of St. Francis was established. Is there anything that your hermitage will be doing to commemorate this?
I hope living day by day a little bit better. Yes, but not in terms of ceremonies or doing anything with the wider church.
Well, it's probably in keeping with St. Francis. Mm-hmm. What do you think?
I think each to his own.
Well, Brother Wayne, it's been a delight talking to you. Thank you so much for coming in to Sydney. What, the third time in 21 years or 22 years?
That's right.
Many are called, but few are chosen. Brother Wayne is one of the three brothers who are the Little Brothers of Francis in Tabulum, New South Wales. And they do have a website, franciscanhermitage.org, where you'll find a slideshow of life with the hermits. You'll find a link to it if you go to the Spirit of Things website, where you can also listen online or download the program at abc.net.au/rn/Spirit of Things. And there's also a link that'll take you inside the Basilica of San Francesco in Assisi. Jeff Wood and I produce this program marking 800 years since the establishment of the Franciscan Order. The sound engineer today was Judy Rapley. Another anniversary is coming up shortly, and that's 500 years since the birth of the great reformer John Calvin on July 10th, 1509. That'll be on the second Sunday in July. Till then, join me again for another adventure into the Spirit of Things at the same time with me, Rachel Kahn.
Strangers, streetwalkers, possums, philosophers, and a whole lot more. These are some of the unforgettable experiences that shaped your city nights. Now, Radio National will select the best audio and written contributions for broadcasts on 360 and The Night Air later this year. But of course, you can pick your own favourites. The full gallery of City Nights entries is at pool.org.au.